The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome to this November 13th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. And as we have been doing the last little bit, we are doing a little survey of our listening audience and inviting you to write in, let us know how we're doing, let us know what you want more of. Maybe want less of. We just want to get your thoughts. And we've gotten so much great feedback. In fact, today's show is based on some of that feedback that we got. But we would just love for you to write in. Barbara's email is penonfire@earthlink.net. penonfire@earthlink.net. You can always write to me at Marie Stone, M-A-R-R-I-E Stone at gmail.com. And yeah, just let us know what you think. So based on your feedback, I'm trying to book more authors for the full hour. You wrote, we listened, and one of the recurring thoughts was to spend a little bit more time with one author and dig really deep. So we are doing that today. And as a reminder, I'm your host, Marie Stone. And as we always do each and every Wednesday morning, we are chatting with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. Today, we are spending the full hour with Kathleen Shine, who was on the show with me way back in 2011. For her novel, The Three Weissmans of Westport. It is a treat to have her back on. Kathleen Shine is the author of the internationally best-selling novels The Love Letter, which was made into a movie starring Kate Capshaw, and Ramu's Niece, which also made into a movie The Misadventures of Margaret, starring Parker Posey. Kathleen's other novels are Alice in Bed, To the Birdhouse, The Evolution of Jane, She Is Me, The New Yorkers, The Three Weissmans of Westport, Finn and Lady. They may not mean to be, but they do. Her new novel, which we are talking about this morning, is The Grammarians. In addition to novels, she has written for The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The New York Times Sunday Magazine, The New York Times Book Review. Her essays have been included in the Best American Essays in 2005, Fierce Pajamas, an anthology of New Yorker humor, and The Big New Yorker Book of Dogs. She grew up in Westport, Connecticut, but she lives now in California. Kathleen, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And to
be here for a whole hour.
I know. I love these hours when we really get to dig deep. I feel like, and a lot of the half hour shows, we get just to the meat of things, and then I'm like, well, time's up, and it's very frustrating.
Yeah. Right.
We need an update on Hector. The last time we were on the air, Hector kind of joined in a little bit, but that was 8 years ago. So we need a Hector update.
My Hector update is rather sad.
Oh, no.
Hector died in August, 1 week away from his 17th birthday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So Hector is no more. Although, in my mind, he's still lying on the table at the vet, sleeping. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. good old Hector. Yes, I remember that interview very well. Hector did join in.
There's some great photos of him up on your website. I encourage people to check out your website because there's so much great stuff up there. But you did an interview with Hector at some point. It was just, it's lovely. And his photos are up there.
Yeah. When we lived in New York.
Yeah. Long live Hector. Oh. So The Grammarians is your 11th novel. I just want to take a moment to process 11 novels. And I'd love to do just sort of a little retrospective across your work. You know, I mean, you've been publishing for almost four decades, since the 80s. And I just wanted to take a moment to look kind of across this whole body of work and across these decades of writing and sort of see if you think about drawing connections across the book, drawing connections about voice or about theme or about your own interests as writer or as woman or as human. Do you recognize yourself across all these 11 books, or do you feel like you keep reinventing yourself each time?
You know, it's funny you ask that, because just last night I was thinking about that, because it's been such a long time, and I've been thinking about, well, you know, I was, when I started writing my first novel, I was still in my late, I was in my late 20s, which now seems like ridiculously young. I mean, it's so far away. But I do think that there's a voice that is maintained, I hope. I mean, I imagine. I don't go back and read my books very often. Sometimes I have to look at them to find something, and I'm often pleasantly surprised and think, oh, that's not bad when I read something. But I feel the same every time I write a book, which is, you know, confused, concerned, am I ever going to be able to write another book? Am I going to be able to write the next page? And at the same time, you know, occasionally this tremendous excitement as I then, you know, will write in a big spurt. So the experience of it has not changed in that regard. The process has changed with every book. I, you know, life changes, and so you sort of work around life in different ways. But I don't know. I get very, very interested in something. And, you know, Darwin or the Enlightenment. And then that affects what I'm writing and becomes part of what I'm writing. And in this case, something that I've long been fascinated by, which is language and linguistics. So the subjects are different, but I think the fact that I get, you know, like very excited and caught up in something, that has remained the same over the years.
Yeah, yeah. I was just trying to do it for myself, like looking across a lot of your books. I mean, I was trying to think, like, I mean, there's humor, you know, all the time, because that's just kind of who you are and your voice. You know, even when you're dealing with pretty grave subject matters, there's some levity and a lot of great humor. And I was kind of thinking identity keeps coming up a lot, you know, and personhood and, you know.
I'm sorry. What did you say? I didn't hear the.
I was just thinking about identity. You know that.
Oh, identity. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That theme kind of crops up a lot, and I don't know. I mean, I just think it's kind of interesting to look at, you know, things across and just kind of see what the connective tissue is between, you know, between the novels, and.
Well, I think with, you know, my very first book, Alice in Bed, was about. And that one was quite autobiographical, but that was about someone, a young woman, I guess 20 years old, 19 years old, in the hospital, in a lot of pain, and yet it was, and not able to walk, and yet it was a comic novel. And so I think that sort of sets the tone for what, you know, for how my work goes, which is, I am very interested in how people absorb adversity one way or another. And I know that, you know, people often say, oh, you know, adversity makes you stronger. I think people who really survive some kind of challenge and adversity are people who manage to stay the same rather than get stronger, that is the strength, to be able to remain yourself even as things change. I mean, which is not to say you don't grow, but to be able to maintain your identity in the midst of all this chaos that is happening. So I think that's something that runs through all the books.
That's really interesting. I'm going to have to dwell on that. That's right. That's right. You kind of answered my next question, which was, you know, does it get easier over the 11 novels? And I guess the answer is no, I guess.
No. I mean, in some ways it does. You know, I'm a little bit more fluent. I can't, if I hit a problem, in a, you know, composing, I can think, oh, well, there are various ways to get through this. which I certainly did not know in the first couple of novels. But in another way, it gets harder because that can take away from the authenticity and freshness of writing, and you don't want to, you know, write in a formulaic way because you know, oh, well, if this happens, then that could happen. Or if a character is stuck in this position, oh, there are these, you know, three basic ways that you can move the character around. Then you end up writing formulaic dreck, which I don't want to do. So it's a constant a battle not to get stale. And also, you know, every time I really do worry that I've run out of ideas. And I'm at the point now where I'm just trying to start another book and thinking, do I have any ideas left? You know, I don't want to repeat myself, but I also don't want to do something just because it's different, you know? So it's always trying to find something sort of, you can't really wait for inspiration. You have to kind of work, and then inspiration comes while you're working. If you wait for it, you'll be waiting. For me, anyway, I'd be waiting forever. But there's just a tension in trying to write something that is fresh and yet something that is real and authentic to me. And I'm you know, 66. So what's that going to be? It's not going to be a 20-year-old. You know, I'm not going to have characters who are. I'm not going to write my first book over again. In other words,
right. Right.
So it's what is my 12th book? You know, I mean, what's that going to be? Yes, it gets harder. Simple answer, yes, it's harder rather than easier, I think.
Well, as you're talking, I'm also thinking that not only do you have to come up with fresh ideas and a fresh way to tell a story, but all those like little details of how you notice life and how you notice human interaction and what your characters look like and all those little things that, you know, the telling details would also get sucked up over 12 novels, right? You know, that you would, you have to find a fresh way to describe, you know, a city or the environment or all those things that, you know, your first ideas are now used up and you have to come up with
That's interesting. I mean, I think that one of the things I sometimes worry about is, I mean, look, a lot of writers, and I certainly draw on memory to for different scenes, for interactions, for the way people see themselves or see each other. You kind of draw on an anecdote or a memory of something, and all, you know, all characters have childhoods, whether they're in the book or not, and so, you know, there's definitely a danger of just using the same anecdote that you've already used, or using a memory that's very, very powerful to you, but it's already manifested itself in another novel. So, you know, that's sort of an interesting challenge that I never expected to have to face. But that's something that's kind of sometimes I think, oh my goodness, have I made this joke before? And, you know, have to be on the alert a little bit. But usually that's less of a problem because the characters are new people who I'm meeting for the first time and have to think about in a new way. And they create their own backgrounds and their, you know, they reveal, I should say, their own childhood or background or thoughts and mannerisms. And that's very exciting. That discovery of new people is always very exciting to me.
I remember the last time we talked and we were talking about, you said that if you find one little thing, like I think you had a character who made some racial slur, or I forget what it was, but something small, a piece of dialogue, a little observation that those little things really open a character up to you and make you realize them as a wholly other person, you know, kind of as you're talking about now. And then they reveal themselves and reveal their own language and how they speak and how they interact and all those things. But I really liked that idea that if you can grip onto, like Elizabeth Strout was on a couple weeks ago, and she said there was some observation of people on the subway, and she said, "Stop sniffing me. You're sniffing me, and I know you're sniffing me." And just that little snippet of you know, just that word sniffing, I think is great. But but just that opened up this whole world of how they talk to each other and who this person was and their backstory. And I do think if you can hook into that little thing.
That's Liz's genius. I mean, you know, she is better at that. And her work is so rich because of those small things kind of just opening up a whole world. And but I do think that that's, you know, a little bit of dialogue, an accent even, or a look that someone gives someone else, you know, while they're speaking. I mean, this can just open up a whole character and a whole world. And in The Grammarians, a lot of this had to do with the words on the page. For me, the words that the characters spoke opened up whole universes of character development and conflict and the way they understood the world and relationships. And a lot of that in this book revealed itself through the way they spoke or what words they chose and why. And that was new and really fun and fascinating for me.
Very fun. So let's set the stage for The Grammarians and get into the nitty-gritty of the book. I'll kind of let you introduce it for people who haven't yet picked it up, who our twins are and kind of how the book came to be.
Well, the book is about twin girls, identical twins, and their names are Daphne and Laurel, and their parents named them after, those are two names really for the same kind of minor goddess. And they are completely fascinated and absorbed by language. From the time they're babies, they have their own secret language. And the book is about what language, it's about their relationship. And how for them language holds them together and ultimately helps split them apart. And it's also about the relationships and how the push and pull of a relationship. I think, well, this is how it came to be. Originally, I wanted to write a book about translation. I don't know why. I just something was going on in the literary world. There, someone was complaining about the translation of Elena Ferrante's books, saying it was too good a translation, made the books better than they were. Hmm. And that amused me, and I thought, oh, I want to write about two translators having a feud about the way something very small is translated. And then I thought, yes, brilliant idea. The only problem is you don't speak any other languages, so that idea is out. And then I thought of my wife said, "Oh, what about Dear Abby? And you know, have you ever thought about Dear Abby and Ann Landers? They were identical twins, and they had a huge feud for their, you know, for their whole adult lives. And that seemed like a really interesting idea. I was a little bit frightened of working." You know, trying to understand twins. But as I started thinking about it, it got more and more interesting, and they seemed like the perfect twins are, you know, the perfect relationship to sort of uncover the dynamic of being so close and at the same time wanting to be individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So I started writing that book, and it was terrible. And also I was in a complete depression because of because of the 2016 election, and everything was terrible and bad, and I couldn't do anything, and, you know, the world was dark, and the page was blank. And then Janet gave me this funny little book to cheer me up called English as She Is Spoke, which is this hilarious book that was written in the 19th century. It is a phrase book for people who speak Portuguese who are in an English-speaking country. The only problem is the person who wrote it apparently had no idea how to speak English. It's possible, it was written in the 19th century. Mark Twain wrote an introduction to it because he thought it was so hilarious. It became a sensation in England and the United States as a comic book that people would read out loud to each other. And it is very funny, and the phrases are hilarious, and the mis, you know, I think it probably went from Portuguese to French, or either French to Portuguese and then to English, or they don't, nobody really knows who wrote it or exactly what, how it came out so crazy. So as soon as she gave me that book, A, it cheered me up, and B, I thought, oh no, this is what I want to write about. This is my hobby, my passion hobby, which is words. And, you know, I go on blogs, to, you know, linguistic blogs, and follow all this stuff that I barely understand. And I thought, this is what's going to happen with these twins. They're going to be language people. And that's how it came about. And once I really started writing it with that in mind, it started to work and sort of blossom and open up.
I'm thinking about a scene in the book where Daphne is struggling with trying to write an article for Vogue, and she can't get access to it. And Laurel gives her the idea of how to approach it, gives her the idea of food. And that scene just comes to me as you're saying your wife gave you this book and it opened everything up, that as the writer is sitting there struggling, trying to figure out what's the door into this material, how do I access it?
Yeah.
It's nice to be open to the outside world for their ideas, and, you know, you never know where they're going to come from, right? And then it just opens things up.
There is a certain amount of serendipity in writing, and yeah, you have to, you know, have your ears and eyes and heart open in order to be creative, I think. And yes, when Laurel is in that scene, is in that chapter, is pregnant and miserable in the early months of pregnancy, and Daphne wants to write a column about words that are fashionable. So this is in the early 80s, and I remember in the early 80s there was suddenly this excitement about food, and food, I mean, people, it's so funny now, the things that were so exotic in the 80s now just seem so normal. But right. You know, arugula was a big deal. Frisé was a big, raspberry vinegar was in every recipe you could imagine, and was considered something, you know, really exotic. So that's what Laurel is able to convey to Daphne, and Daphne is like, oh yeah. So yeah, that's a fashion. Those are fashionable words. Now I can write this piece. The whole thing opens up, and that happens all the time. Well, I wish it happened all the time. When it happens, when you're working or writing or thinking, it's the most exciting, wonderful moment of all when you suddenly see the way forward.
Yes. Yes. That's interesting. Ann Patchett was using the word fashion. And when I came across the word fashion in the Grammarians, it is interesting to see, you know, I mean, aside from fashion, to see what books, what ideas, and, you know, I mean, we're in such a precarious political spot right now. And to see what is in fashion and political fashion, and you know, all of those ideas I think are really interesting. To your point about being miserable in 2016 and writing this, I do have to add in, it was such a pleasure for the days that I spent with this novel to be in the 1980s New York, not here, was just pleasant. You know, it was really nice to be in a time without cell phones, without social media, when they, you know, couldn't just text each other. It was refreshing. I kind of forgot.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the reason I wrote it, was I really wanted it to be a short, funny book. With, I think it has some depth as well, but I needed comfort. I needed distraction, but interesting distraction. And so I wrote the book I needed. And I think, I hope a lot of people, you know, will feel the same way. But, you know, part of me wanted to write like a big political satirical novel, but that's not how I process the world. It's not how I understand the world, and it's not how I write.
Right.
So I did the thing that I was able to do under those circumstances, in those circumstances.
Well, and the other
interesting, a book about twins and words. Go figure.
I have to admit, this is really embarrassing, but I didn't realize until this book that Ann Landers and Dear Abby were, I didn't even know they were related, let alone identical twins. I didn't know that. I don't know how I missed that, because I used to read those columns all the time. And anyway.
Well, isn't it odd? I mean, isn't it sort of amazing? They were identical twins. One of them got a nose job. I forget which one, which I'm sure I used that in the book, and because I'm sure it must have really, that's such a rejection of the other one, you know. I found them fascinating, but not fascinating enough to write about. When I wrote it, they were not, well, first of all, advice columns don't interest me in the same way that language does. So
yeah.
That diminished my fascination with them. But yeah, there are so many identical twins around, they deal with things in different ways.
You know what I think is great about using anything like real life to then create fiction is I always liken it to a swimming pool where versus the ocean. And the swimming pool, Ann Landers and Dear Abby gave you the side of the pool to push off from. And then once you could push off, you could swim on your own, as opposed to just being dumped in an ocean where you have not, you know, you're just flailing out there. But I really like these ideas of anchoring in something, and it just gives you the shove of ideas and enough little interesting details like the nose job to have some creative license. And then you go off and do your own thing, and Daphne and Laurel become their own people. But it gives you something, right?
Go ahead.
It just gives you something, and it's comforting, I think, for a writer to have something to start from.
I think you're right, and I like this watery analogy, because I was talking to someone while I was writing this and saying, everything's terrible. I don't know what to do, and this book seems so small. And this is a friend who is a writer, and she said, we just have to paddle in our own little pond. And each of us has our own little pond that we paddle in. And I found that so inspiring. You know, it's like you can't always think, well, I can never think, and I think it's a bad idea to think I must write something terribly important, because then what you write is something terribly pretentious or terribly formulaic. That, you know, is written for an audience. And I think the more, you know, you kind of focus on paddling in your own little pond, the more important the book becomes to me, and therefore I think the more important it is, period.
I love that. Yeah, I love that. And it takes so much pressure off the writer to write the great American novel, because as you say, that's the straight road to pretension. And I love that. That's Perfect.
Yeah, the great American novel. Just that phrase makes my heart sink. But that's me.
More water analogy. Now you're at the bottom of the pool.
Oh yeah, now it's sinking. You're right.
The other great thing about the language in here was that we're at such a maybe every generation thinks this, but you know, again, we're at such a bleak time in our not just our political lives, but we're at such a precipice on this technological whatever conundrum we find ourselves in, and it's really changing our language itself. I mean, the way we communicate, texting, tweeting, however we communicate with LOLs and you know SMH. It's really, I think, not only is the language changing, but it's changing our brain. And so this revisitation of grammar, the proper way to speak, how we order words and how the order of those words changes things, all of that stuff, I think it is so important right now as we're watching our literal way that we communicate with each other shifting beneath our feet. And this just felt like the right book at the right time to remind us of all of that.
Oh, well, thank you. But, you know, as you said that, I was thinking I had a brief moment when I was trying to be a medievalist. And one of the things I had to do was learn paleography so I could read medieval texts. And the reason was that the scribes, their hands would get tired. And they, you know, and it was very expensive to write on the sheepskin and vellum and all the things that they used, and they used a lot of abbreviations. I mean, a lot. So not unlike LOL, and you had to learn as you read various documents. You had to learn that a line over them meant there was a. You know, an UM at the end and that kind of thing. And so, you know, I don't think that it's so shocking and terrible that with each kind of technology, because that was a kind of technology, I guess you'd have to say, or you could say with each medium, that the language will change, written language will change. The typewriter changed written language as well. Mm-hmm. Printing changed things. And this has changed things, but it's also created a lot of new ways of saying things in good ways. And so I am not a anti Twitter person. In fact, I'm an obsessive Twitter person.
Me too.
Which is unfortunate. It's very time consuming and keeps me up at night. Never go on Twitter before bed. That I've learned because of political things. But I think that all of this should be that we need to be open to all of this kind of writing and all of the words that come out in the world. I mean, who would ever have predicted that podcasts would be so popular? I mean, podcasts are radio. Radio is old-fashioned. Radio is what my mother grew up with. You know, who would have predicted that? So I think it's all really interesting. And, yes, grammar for me is fascinating and important, and we need to be able to express ourselves clearly and have language mean things rather than obscure things. But that, you know, that having been said, if that's your goal, then I think the changes in language are not necessarily bad. It's all about clarity and expression and beauty, and imagination.
Right. Your dictionary of choice in the book was Samuel Johnson's English Dictionary. And I'd love to get your take on that dictionary and why you love it so much.
Well, the dictionary that the girls are obsessed with is Merriam-Webster's second edition, International Dictionary.
Yeah, right.
Which was the one right before the 60s when the third edition came out, which... was a big, in the world of lexicography, was a big scandal. It was sort of like the mini skirt of dictionaries, in that there was a lot of slang and that had never been allowed before. But Samuel Johnson's dictionary is sort of like a postmodern novel. I mean, reading it is quite wonderful. I found that the whole thing is online, and facsimiles of a facsimile of the entire dictionary, and just going through it and seeing. I mean, he could be quite funny in his definitions, and also a lot of the words are interesting and have a different meaning now than they used to, and all of that kind of just drew me into it. And there's a dictionary definition of a word at the head of each chapter. That did not happen until the book was completely done.
Oh.
I had a sense that I was going to do that, but I didn't do it until the end. And that for me was very important, because when I decided, you know, I would use one word and then I'd read the chapter through and I'd think, no, it's the wrong word. And then I'd find another. And when I found the right word is when I really understood what each chapter was about. So it was a kind of ass-backward way of defining the chapters. But it was a revelation to me. When I found the exact right word, I'd think, oh. And it made the chapter resonate in a way that I could just feel was right. And so that was a lot of that was fun. That was the best part of the whole. I mean, that was like sanctioned procrastination, you know. I could just sit and read this dictionary and poke around for days, for weeks, and it was like, oh, I'm working. But it was really just, it was wonderful, it was heavenly.
That's really interesting you say that for a lot of reasons. But so you wrote the book you wrote the book as the book is, which is basically chronological. And mm-hmm. then it's because the last time we talked, we were talking a little bit about outlining after the fact. And when the manuscript is completely done, you go back and try and kind of make sense of it. And now you understand what it's really mm-hmm. about and who the characters are and their arc and all that stuff. So this technique of making sense of each chapter by the word that it's trying to, you know, illuminate it strikes me mm-hmm. as another way to do that. Another way to
yes.
outline it in an interesting lexicon sort of way. I love that. Interesting.
Yeah. I have to finish a book before I really understand it. And even then, it's very hard for me to just give a short definition. You know, if someone say, "What's the book about?" and I just say,
200 pages. Yeah, 300 pages is what it's about.
These words. it is a way of going back and outlining it essentially, or at least exposing the outline that's there. There's, you know, it's usually there. It's just a question of for me, you know, trying to see it after it's done. I certainly, you know, if I had done that, if I had used words ahead of time before I wrote the chapters would have been very, very dull. I never could have done that. Some people, you know, that's how some people write. They go forward. I go backward after I'm done.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a really good way to illuminate the dangers, pitfalls, or I guess, you know, if that's the way you write, help crutch of outlining is if you had those words, you're right, at the very beginning, you would have written to the word as opposed to written organically, and it would have given it a much different feel, I would think. That's great. My dear husband gave me the OED, all of it, like on many shelves.
You're so lucky.
So fun. Yeah, it's so fun. Yeah, they're all the history and origins and all of those words. I mean, talk about being able to fall into a book or 24.
You don't have all the volumes, do you?
I do.
You have like the big.
Yeah, I have all the volumes. He first bought the...
You're so lucky.
He first bought those two little ones, but you needed a magnifying glass and you can't see it.
Yeah, it's impossible. Oh, my goodness, you have all the... Oh, I'm so jealous. That's wonderful.
They're so cool. You're also reminding me... here's a weird confession, but when I was in college, I used to before I'd have to sit down and write a paper, I just picked two stupid words that had nothing to do with anything, just two words that I liked or they sounded pleasurable or whatever. And then I would use those words, which I came to understand is really free writing. But in college, I didn't know that. But I would construct a whole paper around just a couple pleasing sounding words. And, you know, then I don't know if you
like
do a lot
that.
Of free writing.
It sounds like a prompt, you know, in a writing class. I think sometimes I inadvertently do that. There are words that are sort of stuck in my head or but I know sometimes I write word to word. So, you know, one word just sort of leads me to the next word, which leads me to the sentence, which leads me through this thought that I hadn't realized I was going to think. Maybe that's how everyone really writes. I think the definition of that is thought. But I do sometimes feel like, the sound of a word leads me to the next word just as much as the meaning of the word sometimes.
Yes, right. Well, that gets to the poetry. I mean, there's a, one of our twins turns into a poet. I don't know if I'm giving too much away, but there is some poetry in here. And I was going to ask you about poetry and kind of what that has meant to your writing, if you are a big reader of poetry and if it kind of informed some of this book. Obviously did.
I read poetry. I go through phases where I read a lot, where that's all I read. And then I go through phases of years where I barely read any poetry. It's a different kind of concentration and absorption. So in this book, what happened was I was reading for research a book about English language and grammar written by Charles Fries, who was a linguist and teacher and who had collected all of these for his book about language, for his grammar book, had collected all of these excerpts from letters from soldiers right before World War II. They were letters from families of soldiers saying, complaints about things or, please find my son or we need my father here because, we're so poor. And they were, he had different, some of them were more formal and some of them were non-standard English. Written by people who wrote with bad spelling and non-standard English. And his purpose was just to show that there are different ways of saying things, and he wasn't saying one is good and one is bad. He was saying there's standard English, and then there's the way a lot of people really do speak. And it was very interesting. But as I was reading them, they were so touching, heartbreaking, some of them. And they stopped being excerpts showing me grammar, and they really started being voices. And then that's what happened when Laurel read them, and they became a kind of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very organic thing that happened to me as I was researching, which I then allowed Laurel to experience in a similar way.
Really interesting. That's really beautiful. I should remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and I am on with Kathleen Shine. The book is The Grammarians. It's funny, the last time we talked, I don't know if you were living on the, maybe you were living on the West Coast then, but I also just wanted to ask you about that move from East Coast to West Coast and how that itself might have changed your writing community, changed your perspective on life. Did it make a difference being on one coast versus the other to your writing life?
I think two things happened. One is I feel like I'm on a working vacation every day that I wake up. I can't believe where I am. I wonder if I'll ever get used to it. I've been here, really living here, almost 10 years. I don't know if I'll ever become blasé about looking out the window and seeing what I see. I mean, I love it here. I love it when it's foggy, which it often is because we live in Venice. I love it when the sun is out. I love every palm tree. I can't believe where I am. So that's one thing. And it's less stressful in certain ways. It's more stressful in other ways in that my family, my mother and my brother, live in New York, and I'm constantly going back to see my mother, who's quite old now. So, but, you know, that's a price that I pay for having this working vacation life. But the other thing that's wonderful about being here is I'm out of the bubble of New York publishing, which is very intense. most of my friends are writers or, you know, novelists or journalists or nonfiction writers, but writers. And there's this constant pressure and stress and nervousness. You know, everybody is under the gun. And there's a temptation to get caught up in that and to measure success against someone else's success, and to even think about success is kind of disastrous for the creative process, I think, unless you're thinking about the success of the actual work. So that's been a great relief to get away from that. The downside of that is sometimes I feel I'm very out of it because most of my friends are New York people, writers. I don't know a lot of L.A. writers. I'm beginning to know more. There are a lot of people here. I just don't know them yet. So it's kind of like being on a beautiful island without the stress of a big city, but sometimes feeling a little bit on the outside, on the outskirts. And I think I like that.
Interesting. It's funny because the last time we talked,
I don't think it's affected the way I write, except that now I have a much better view while I'm writing.
Right. Yeah, we were talking last time about how some of the easier characters to access are the eccentric characters. You really liked the eccentric people, and I was thinking, I think you live in Venice, so I'm like, there's no more eccentric people in the world, maybe, than Venice, California. But, you know, if it's...
Yeah, they're almost too eccentric to... And those people are... There are fewer and fewer. It's really changed, even in the last 10 years. I mean, it's very... there are a lot of young, less eccentric, sort of techie people. And I don't hang out on the beach. That's not my, on the boardwalk part of the beach. That's not my scene.
right.
So those eccentrics, I can, you know, they're a bit extreme for my taste. I think most people are eccentric. I know that's a contradiction, but, I like the eccentricities of normal people. Of finding what is really odd about someone who seems, from the outside or at first glance, to be a perfectly reasonable, normal person, to try to understand what oddities they have and the way they see the world in a slightly crooked way. That I really like and find fascinating.
Was that more difficult when you're working with identical twins to make them? I mean, they're eccentric. Their unit is very eccentric. But then, as they become individual women and grapple with each other, they have to have their own eccentricities. Obviously, was that more? Do you think difficult or more pleasurable or easy dealing with identical twins trying to draw their characters out?
It wasn't as obvious to me who they were going to become. And it happened very gradually. They started out, as you say, as a unit, an eccentric unit. But even within that unit, I already felt some differences between them. And then they really, as characters do, they really began to go their own way and push back at anything I tried to, to impose on them. They kind of revealed themselves as different. And I was concerned that they wouldn't be different enough. I was concerned about whether or not they were going to have real characters and reveal themselves. But I think finally they did. I think I was successful in that. And it's not that it was harder. I was more worried about it. But I think that they, in some ways, they were so, those two little girls were so powerful to me. Their personalities were so strong that it was a little bit like having, really difficult children and watching them grow up. And so in some ways it was almost easier.
Yeah, they were
so insistent.
Right. They're very willful. Right. Right.
Yeah. They are willful.
Yeah, they really struck me as almost easier to write because of their strong will. It did feel, even to the reader's perspective, that it must have, from the writer's side, felt like the tail wagging the dog, or whatever the saying is about, they really were going to tell you who they were and what they were going to do. And that was
fun. And in some ways, they had the other one to take off from. So, the split between them, really revealed certain things about their character. And then each one's need to be an individual while still having this tremendous need to be close to the other twin, underlined the differences between them.
I'm going to steal this observation from somebody else. I can't take credit for it because I didn't think of it before I read it. But a lot of the characters did have a counterpart in here. Their father had a brother who felt like his kind of counterpart. So there was mm-hmm. this pleasurable play with not just the obvious twins in the book, but all of these other twin opposing pulling forces that were in relation to each other. And that was really fun. And I don't know if that was intentional.
That was, I think not, I wasn't, totally aware of that as I was doing it, but I think I recently, became aware of this wonderful, band, Tegan and Sarah, and they're identical twins. And I've listened to their music a lot now. And as I was listening to it, one of the songs, for example, I thought was about someone breaking up with a lover. And I later discovered it was about one of the twins moving out and leaving the other twin behind at a certain point. And it made me realize that a lot of what this book is about is just that movement, that the magnetic pull of a relationship and of intimacy, and then the opposite magnetic pulling away, where you want to have your own identity. And it made me think about how much of certainly popular culture, like Tegan and Sarah's songs, literature, operas, high culture as well as popular culture, how much of that is about those two contrasting poles or impulses. And I think that's what made this book, made a lot of things come to, I don't want to use the word come together, made a lot of things blossom, let's say, for me. Mm-hmm. The fact that that's what a lot of art is about, And that's what a lot of life is about. It's about wanting to be close. You know, you desperately want to be close to someone and have their arms around you. And at the same time, it's like, stop it, I can't breathe. You know, I need some independence. So I think that's a lot of what the book is about.
So well observed. Exactly right. God, we're out of time. Can you imagine if we tried to cram that into a half hour? Would it never work?
No, I really can't. But now I'm going back to the hearings.
Oh, I know. We all are. Right.
To the impeachment hearings. But no, I really can't imagine. So this was wonderful.
It was wonderful. I'm going to direct people to your website, which is your name, KathleenShine.com, I think. Yeah. I think it's just your name.com.
Me.
Oh, me. Dot me. You're right.
I lost my domain name I forgot to renew it or something. It turned out at some point to be, at one point it was a Japanese softcore porn site. So be careful if you go to .com. No, it's .me.
Good catch. On there are all these, you know, wonderful interviews. People can get more information on all the stuff we didn't talk about today, about what you're reading and what you recommend to read, interviews you've done, all that stuff, information on all 11 books. So check that out. And what a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you. And thank you for remembering Hector. That made me happy. Hector, yeah. The dog.
We are fans of Hector. We're going to keep Hector close.
All right. He's immortalized.
He is. Thank you so much. All right. Thanks again.
All right.
That was Kathleen Shine. The book, The Grammarians, is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day, and stay tuned for more programming on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.